floored me. Quote, "What makes social and political arguments conservative, as opposed to orthodox, is that the critique of liberal or progressive arguments takes place on the enlightened grounds of the search for human happiness based on the use of reason." End quote. As a lifelong liberal, I had assumed that conservatism equals orthodoxy, equals religion, equals faith, equals rejection of science. It followed, therefore, that as an atheist and a scientist, I was obligated to be a liberal. But Muller asserted that modern conservatism is really about creating the best possible society, the one that brings about the greatest happiness given local circumstances. Could it be? Was there a kind of conservatism that could compete against liberalism in the court of social science? Might conservatives have a better formula for how to create a healthy, happy society? I kept reading. Muller went through a series of claims about human nature and institutions, which he said are the core beliefs of conservatism. Conservatives believe that people are inherently imperfect and are prone to act badly when all constraints and accountability are removed. Yes, I thought. See Glaucon, Tetlock, and Ariely in Chapter 4. Our reasoning is flawed and prone to overconfidence, so it's dangerous to construct theories based on pure reason, unconstrained by intuition and historical experience. Yes, see Hume in Chapter 2 and Baron Cohen on Systemizing in Chapter 6. Institutions emerge gradually as social facts, which we then respect and even sacralize, but if we strip these institutions of authority and treat them as arbitrary contrivances that exist only for our benefit, we render them less effective. We then expose ourselves to increased anomie and social disorder. Yes, see Durkheim in Chapters 8 and 11. Based on my own research, I had no choice but to agree with these conservative claims. As I continued to read the writings of conservative intellectuals, from Edmund Burke in the 18th century through Friedrich Hayek and Thomas Sowell in the 20th, I began to see that they had attained a crucial insight into the sociology of morality that I had never encountered before. They understood the importance of what I'll call moral capital. Please note that I am praising conservative intellectuals, not the Republican Party. The term social capital swept through the social sciences in the 1990s, jumping into the broader public vocabulary after Robert Putnam's 2000 book, Bowling Alone. Capital, in economics, refers to the resources that allow a person or firm to produce goods or services. There's financial capital, money in the bank, physical capital, such as a wrench or a factory, and human capital, such as a well-trained sales force. When everything else is equal, a firm with more of any kind of capital will outcompete a firm with less. Social capital refers to a kind of capital that economists had largely overlooked. The social ties among individuals and the norms of reciprocity and trustworthiness that arise from those ties. When everything else is equal, a firm with more social capital will outcompete its less cohesive and less internally trusting competitors, which makes sense given that human beings were shaped by multi-level selection to be contingent cooperators. In fact, discussions of social capital sometimes use the example of ultra-Orthodox Jewish diamond merchants, which I mentioned in the previous chapter. This tightly knit ethnic group has been able to create the most efficient market because their transaction and monitoring costs are so low. There's less overhead on every deal. And their costs are so low because they trust each other. If a rival market were to open up across town, composed of ethnically and religiously diverse merchants, they'd have to spend a lot more money on lawyers and security guards, given how easy it is to commit fraud or theft when sending diamonds out for inspection by other merchants. Like the non-religious communes studied by Richard Sosis, they'd have a much harder time getting individuals to follow the moral norms of the community. Everyone loves social capital. Whether you're left, right, or center, who could fail to see the value of being able to trust and rely upon others? But now, let's broaden our focus beyond firms trying to produce goods, and let's think about a school, a commune, a corporation, or even a whole nation that wants to improve moral behavior. Let's set aside problems of moral diversity and just specify the goal as increasing the output of pro-social behaviors and decreasing the output of antisocial behaviors, however the group defines those terms. To achieve almost any moral vision, you'd probably want high levels of social capital. It's hard to imagine how anomie and distrust could be beneficial. But will linking people together into healthy, trusting relationships be enough to improve the ethical profile of the group? If you believe that people are inherently good, and that they flourish when constraints and divisions are removed, then yes, that may be sufficient. But conservatives generally take a very different view of human nature. They believe that people need external structures or constraints in order to behave well, cooperate, and thrive. These external constraints include laws, institutions, customs, traditions, nations, and religions. People who hold this constrained view are therefore very concerned about the health and integrity of these outside-the-mind coordination devices. Without them, they believe, people will begin to cheat and behave selfishly. Without them, social capital will rapidly decay. If you are a member of a weird society, your eyes tend to fall on individual objects, such as people, and you don't automatically see the relationships among them. Having a concept such as social capital is helpful because it forces you to see relationships within which those people are embedded and which make those people more productive. I propose that we take this approach one step further. To understand the miracle of moral communities that grow beyond the bounds of kinship, we must look not just at people and not just at the relationships among people, but at the complete environment within which those relationships are embedded and which makes those people more virtuous, however they themselves define that term. It takes a great deal of outside-the-mind stuff to support a moral community. For example, on a small island or in a small town, you typically don't need to lock your bicycle. But in a big city in the same country, if you only lock the bike frame, your wheels may get stolen. Being small, isolated, or morally homogeneous are examples of environmental conditions that increase the moral capital of a community. That doesn't mean that small islands and small towns are better places to live overall. The diversity and crowding of big cities makes them more creative and interesting places for many people. But that's the trade-off. Whether you trade away some moral capital to gain some diversity and creativity will depend in part on your brain's settings on traits such as openness to experience and threat sensitivity. And this is part of the reason why cities are usually so much more liberal than the countryside. Looking at a bunch of outside-the-mind factors and at how well they mesh with inside-the-mind moral psychology brings us right back to the definition of moral systems that I gave in the last chapter. In fact, we can define moral capital as the resources that sustain a moral community. More specifically, moral capital refers to the degree to which a community possesses interlocking sets of values, virtues, norms, practices, identities, institutions, and technologies that mesh well with evolved psychological mechanisms and thereby enable the community to suppress or regulate selfishness and make cooperation possible. End quote. To see moral capital in action, let's do a thought experiment using the 19th century communes studied by Richard Sosis. Let's assume that every commune was started by a group of 25 adults who knew, liked, and trusted one another. In other words, let's assume that every commune started with a high and equal quantity of social capital on day one. What factors enabled some communes to maintain their social capital and generate high levels of pro-social behavior for decades, while others degenerated into discord and distrust within the first year? In the last chapter, I said that belief in gods and costly religious rituals turned out to be crucial ingredients of success. But let's put religion aside and look at other kinds of outside-the-mind stuff. Let's assume that each commune started off with a clear list of values and virtues that it printed on posters and displayed throughout the commune. A commune that valued self-expression over conformity and that prized the virtue of tolerance over the virtue of loyalty might be more attractive to outsiders, and this could indeed be an advantage in recruiting new members. But it would have lower moral capital than a commune that valued conformity and loyalty. The stricter commune would be better able to suppress or regulate selfishness, and would therefore be more likely to endure. Moral communities are fragile things, hard to build and easy to destroy. When we think about very large communities such as nations, the challenge is extraordinary and the threat of moral entropy is intense. There is not a big margin for error. Many nations are failures as moral communities, particularly corrupt nations where dictators and elites run the country for their own benefit. If you don't value moral capital, then you won't foster values, virtues, norms, practices, identities, institutions, and technologies that increase it. Let me state clearly that moral capital is not always an unalloyed good. Moral capital leads automatically to the suppression of free riders, but it does not lead automatically to other forms of fairness, such as equality of opportunity. And while high moral capital helps a community to function efficiently, the community can use that efficiency to inflict harm on other communities. High moral capital can be obtained within a cult or a fascist nation, as long as most people truly accept the prevailing moral matrix. Nonetheless, if you are trying to change an organization or a society, and you do not consider the effects of your changes on moral capital, you're asking for trouble. This, I believe, is the fundamental blind spot of the left. It explains why liberal reforms so often backfire, and why communist revolutions usually end up in despotism. It is the reason I believe that liberalism, which has done so much to bring about freedom and equal opportunity, is not sufficient as a governing philosophy. It tends to overreach, change too many things too quickly, and reduce the stock of moral capital inadvertently. Conversely, while conservatives do a better job of preserving moral capital, they often fail to notice certain classes of victims, fail to limit the predations of certain powerful interests, and fail to see the need to change or update institutions as times change. A yin and two yangs. In Chinese philosophy, yin and yang refer to any pair of contrasting or seemingly opposed forces that are in fact complementary and interdependent. Night and day are not enemies, nor are hot and cold, summer and winter, male and female. We need both, often in a shifting or alternating balance. John Stuart Mill said that liberals and conservatives are like this, quote, "A party of order and stability and a party of progress or reform are both necessary elements of a healthy state of political life." End quote. The philosopher Bertrand Russell saw this same dynamic at work throughout Western intellectual history. Quote, "From 600 BC to the present day, philosophers have been divided into those who wish to tighten social bonds and those who wish to relax them." End quote. Russell then explained why both sides are partially right, using terms that are about as close a match to moral capital as I could ever hope to find. Quote, "It is clear that each party to this dispute, as to all that persists through long periods of time, is partly right and partly wrong. Social cohesion is a necessity, and mankind has never yet succeeded in enforcing cohesion by merely rational arguments. Every community is exposed to two opposite dangers. Ossification through too much discipline and reverence for tradition on the one hand, on the other hand, dissolution or subjection to foreign conquest through the growth of an individualism and personal independence that makes cooperation impossible." End quote. I'm going to take a risk and apply Mill's and Russell's insights to some current debates in American society. It's a risk because partisan readers may be able to accept my claims about yin and yang in the abstract, but not when I start saying that the other side has something useful to say about specific controversial issues. I'm willing to run this risk, however, because I want to show that public policy might really be improved by drawing on insights from all sides. I'll use the framework of Durkheimian utilitarianism that I developed at the end of Chapter 11. That is, I'm going to evaluate each issue based on how well the ideology in question can advance the overall good of a society. That's the utilitarian part. But I'm going to adopt a view of humankind as being homo duplex, or 90% chimp, 10% bee, which means that we humans need access to healthy hives in order to flourish. That's the Durkheimian part. Rather than just contrasting the left and the right, I'm going to divide the opponents of the left into two groups, the social conservatives, such as the religious right, and the libertarians, sometimes called classical liberals because of their love of free markets. These are two groups we've studied a lot at yourmorals.org, and we find that they have very different personalities and moralities. In what follows, I'll say briefly why I think that liberals are justified on two major points. I'll then say where I think libertarians and social conservatives are justified on two counterpoints. Yin, liberal wisdom. The left builds its moral matrix on three of the six foundations, but it rests most firmly and consistently on the CARE Foundation. We might illustrate it as in Figure 12.2, where the thickness of each line corresponds to the importance of each foundation. Figure 12.2 shows a box with the words in it, "The Liberal Moral Matrix, Most Sacred Value, Care for Victims of Oppression." Below that box are six smaller boxes showing each of the six foundations. The Liberal Moral Matrix is shown to rest primarily on the CARE Harm Foundation. There's a very thick line connecting the two. Then a thinner line to Liberty Oppression, a thinner line to Fairness Cheating, and then very thin lines to Loyalty, Authority, and Sanctity. Liberals are often suspicious of appeals to loyalty, authority, and sanctity, although they don't reject these intuitions in all cases. Think of the sanctification of nature. So I drew those lines as thin, but still existing. Liberals have many specific values, but I think it's helpful for each group to identify its most sacred value, the third rail that will get you electrocuted if you touch it. For American liberals since the 1960s, I believe that the most sacred value is caring for victims of oppression. Anyone who blames such victims for their own problems, or who displays or merely excuses prejudice against sacralized victim groups, can expect a vehement tribal response. Our findings at yourmorals.org match up with philosophical and popular definitions of liberalism that emphasize care for the vulnerable, opposition to hierarchy and oppression, and an interest in changing laws, traditions, and institutions to solve social problems. The liberal radio host Garrison Keillor captured the spirit and self-image of the modern American left when he wrote, quote, "I am a liberal, and liberalism is the politics of kindness." Liberals stand for tolerance, magnanimity, community spirit, the defense of the weak against the powerful, love of learning, freedom of belief, art and poetry, city life, the very things that make America worth dying for, end quote. I'm not sure how many Americans have sacrificed their lives for kindness and poetry, but I believe this moral matrix leads liberals to make two points consistently, points that I believe are essential for the health of a society. Point number one, governments can and should restrain corporate superorganisms. I loved the movie Avatar, but it contained the most foolish evolutionary thinking I've ever seen. I found it easier to believe that islands could float in the sky than to believe that all creatures could live in harmony, willingly lying down to let others eat them. There was one futuristic element that I found quite believable, however. The movie depicts Earth, a few centuries from now, as a planet run by corporations that have turned national governments into their lackeys. In Chapter 9, I talked about major transitions in the evolution of life. I described the process by which superorganisms emerge, dominate their preferred niches, change their ecosystems, and push their competitors to the margins or to extinction. In Chapter 10, I show that corporations are superorganisms. They're not like superorganisms. They are actual superorganisms. So if the past is any guide, corporations will grow ever more powerful as they evolve and as they change the legal and political systems of their host countries to become ever more hospitable. The only force left on Earth that can stand up to the largest corporations are national governments, some of which still maintain the power to tax, regulate, and divide corporations into smaller pieces when they get too powerful. Economists speak of externalities, the costs or benefits incurred by third parties who did not agree to the transaction causing the cost or benefit. For example, if a farmer begins using a new kind of fertilizer that increases his yield but causes more damaging runoff into nearby rivers, he keeps the profit, but the costs of his decision are borne by others. If a factory farm finds a faster way to fatten up cattle, but thereby causes the animals to suffer more digestive problems and broken bones, it keeps the profit, and the animals pay the cost. Corporations are obligated to maximize profit for shareholders, and that means looking for any and all opportunities to lower costs, including passing costs on to others, when legal, in the form of externalities. I am not anti-corporate. I am simply a Glauconian. When corporations operate in full view of the public, with a free press that is willing and able to report on the externalities being foisted on the public, they are likely to behave well, as most corporations do. But many corporations operate with a high degree of secrecy and public invisibility. For example, America's giant food processors and factory farms. And many corporations have the ability to capture or otherwise influence the politicians and federal agencies whose job it is to regulate them, especially now that the U.S. Supreme Court has given corporations and unions the right to make unlimited donations to political causes. When corporations are given the Ring of Gyges, we can expect catastrophic results for the ecosystem, the banking system, public health, etc. I think liberals are right that a major function of government is to stand up for the public interest against corporations and their tendency to distort markets and impose externalities on others, particularly on those least able to stand up for themselves in court, such as the poor or immigrants or farm animals. Efficient markets require government regulation. Liberals go too far sometimes. Indeed, they are often reflexively anti-business, which is a huge mistake from a utilitarian point of view. But it is healthy for a nation to have a constant tug of war, a constant debate between yin and yang over how and when to limit and regulate corporate behavior. Point number two. Some problems really can be solved by regulation. As automobile ownership skyrocketed in the 1950s and 1960s, so did the tonnage of lead being blown out of American tailpipes and into the atmosphere, 200,000 tons of lead a year by 1973. Gasoline refiners had been adding lead since the 1930s to increase the efficiency of the refining process. Despite evidence that the rising tonnage of lead was making its way into the lungs, bloodstreams, and brains of Americans and was retarding the neural development of millions of children, the chemical industry had been able to block all efforts to ban lead additives from gasoline for decades. It was a classic case of corporate superorganisms using all methods of leverage to preserve their ability to pass a deadly externality on to the public. The Carter administration began a partial phase-out of leaded gasoline, but it was nearly reversed when Ronald Reagan crippled the Environmental Protection Agency's ability to draft new regulations or enforce old ones. A bipartisan group of congressmen stood up for children and against the chemical industry, and by the 1990s, lead had been completely removed from gasoline. This simple public health intervention worked miracles. Lead levels in children's blood dropped in lockstep with declining levels of lead in gasoline, and the decline has been credited with some of the rise in IQ that has been measured in recent decades. Even more amazingly, several studies have demonstrated that the phase-out, which began in the late 1970s, may have been responsible for up to half of the extraordinary and otherwise unexplained drop in crime that occurred in the 1990s. Tens of millions of children, particularly poor children in big cities, had grown up with high levels of lead, which interfered with their neural development from the 1950s until the late 1970s. The boys in this group went on to cause the giant surge of criminality that terrified America and drove it to the right from the 1960s until the early 1990s. These young men were eventually replaced by a new generation of young men with unleaded brains and therefore better impulse control, which seems to be part of the reason the crime rate plummeted. From a Durkheimian utilitarian perspective, it is hard to imagine a better case for government intervention to solve a national health problem. This one regulation saved vast quantities of lives, IQ points, money, and moral capital all at the same time. And lead is far from the only environmental hazard that disrupts neural development. When young children are exposed to PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, organophosphates, used in some pesticides, and methylmercury, a byproduct of burning coal, it lowers their IQ and raises their risk of ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Given these brain disruptions, future studies are likely to find a link to violence and crime as well. Rather than building more prisons, the cheapest and most humane way to fight crime may be to give more money and authority to the Environmental Protection Agency. When conservatives object that liberal efforts to intervene in markets or engage in social engineering always have unintended consequences, they should note that sometimes those consequences are positive. When conservatives say that markets offer better solutions than do regulations, let them step forward and explain their plan to eliminate the dangerous and unfair externalities generated by many markets. Yang number one, libertarian wisdom. Libertarians are sometimes said to be socially liberal, favoring individual freedom in private matters such as sex and drug use, and economically conservative, favoring free markets. But those labels reveal how confused these terms have become in the United States. Libertarians are the direct descendants of the 18th and 19th century Enlightenment reformers who fought to free people and markets from the control of kings and clergy. Libertarians love liberty. That is their sacred value. Many libertarians wish they could simply be known as liberals, but they lost that term in the United States, though not in Europe, when liberalism split into two camps in the late 19th century. Some liberals began to see powerful corporations and wealthy industrialists as the chief threats to liberty. These new liberals, also known as left liberals or progressives, looked to government as the only force capable of protecting the public and rescuing the many victims of the brutal practices of early industrial capitalism. Liberals who continued to fear government as the chief threat to liberty became known as classical liberals, right liberals in some countries, or libertarians in the United States. Those who took the progressive path began to use government not just to safeguard liberty, but to advance the general welfare of the people, particularly those who could not fend for themselves. Progressive Republicans, such as Theodore Roosevelt, and Democrats, such as Woodrow Wilson, took steps to limit the growing power of corporations, such as breaking up monopolies and creating new government agencies to regulate labor practices and to ensure the quality of foods and medicines. Some progressive reforms intruded far more deeply into private life and personal liberty, such as forcing parents to send their children to school and banning the sale of alcohol. You can see this fork in the road by looking at the liberal moral matrix, figure 12.2. It rests on two foundations primarily, care and liberty, plus some fairness, because everybody values proportionality to some extent. Liberals in 1900, who relied most heavily on the care foundation, those who felt the pain of others most keenly, were predisposed to take the left-hand, progressive fork. But liberals in 1900, who relied more heavily on the liberty foundation, those who felt the bite of restrictions on their liberty most keenly, refused to follow. See Figure 12.3. Figure 12.3 shows a box that says, "The Libertarian Moral Matrix, Most Sacred Value, Individual Liberty." It rests overwhelmingly on the Liberty Oppression Foundation. In fact, the libertarian writer Will Wilkinson has recently suggested that libertarians are basically liberals who love markets and lack bleeding hearts. At yourmorals.org, we've found that Wilkinson is correct. In a project led by Ravi Iyer and Sena Koleva, we analyzed dozens of surveys completed by 12,000 libertarians, and we compared their responses to those of tens of thousands of liberals and conservatives. We found that libertarians look more like liberals than like conservatives on most measures of personality. For example, both groups score higher than conservatives on openness to experience and lower than conservatives on disgust sensitivity and conscientiousness. On the Moral Foundations questionnaire, libertarians join liberals in scoring very low on the loyalty, authority, and sanctity foundations. Where they diverge from liberals most sharply is on two measures: the care foundation, where they score very low, even lower than conservatives, and on some new questions we added about economic liberty, where they score extremely high, a little higher than conservatives, a lot higher than liberals. For example, do you agree that the government should do more to advance the common good, even if that means limiting the freedom and choices of individuals? If so, then you are probably a liberal. If not, then you could be either a libertarian or a conservative. The split between liberals, or progressives, and libertarians, or classical liberals, occurred over exactly this question more than 100 years ago, and it shows up clearly in our data today. People with libertarian ideals have generally supported the Republican Party since the 1930s because libertarians and Republicans have a common enemy, the liberal welfare society that they believe is destroying America's liberty, for libertarians, and moral fiber, for social conservatives. I believe that libertarians are right on many points, but I'll focus on just one counterpoint to liberalism here. Counterpoint number one, markets are miraculous. In 2007, David Goldhill's father was killed by an infection he caught while in the hospital. In trying to make sense of this unnecessary death, Goldhill began to read about the American healthcare system, which kills about 100,000 people annually by such accidental infections. He learned that the death rate can be cut by two-thirds when hospitals follow a simple checklist of sanitary procedures, but most hospitals don't adopt the checklist. Goldhill, a businessman and Democrat, wondered how it was possible for any organization to pass up a simple measure that yielded such massive payoffs. In the business world, such inefficiency would soon lead to bankruptcy. As he learned more and more about the healthcare system, he discovered just how bad things get when goods and services are provided without a properly functioning market. In 2009, Goldhill published a provocative essay in The Atlantic titled, "How American Healthcare Killed My Father." One of his main points was the absurdity of using insurance to pay for routine purchases. Normally, we buy insurance to cover the risk of a catastrophic loss. We enter an insurance pool with other people to spread the risk around, and we hope never to collect a penny. We handle routine expenses ourselves, seeking out the highest quality for the lowest price. We would never file a claim on our car insurance to pay for an oil change. The next time you go to the supermarket, look closely at a can of peas. Think about all the work that went into it. The farmers, truckers, and supermarket employees, the miners and metal workers who made the can. And think how miraculous it is that you can buy this can for under a dollar. At every step of the way, competition among suppliers rewarded those whose innovations shaved a penny off the cost of getting that can to you. If God is commonly thought to have created the world and then arranged it for our benefit, then the free market, and its invisible hand, is a pretty good candidate for being a god. You can begin to understand why libertarians sometimes have a quasi-religious faith in free markets. Now, let's do the devil's work and spread chaos throughout the marketplace. Suppose that one day all prices are removed from all products in the supermarket. All labels, too, beyond a simple description of the contents, so you can't compare products from different companies. You just take whatever you want, as much as you want, and you bring it up to the register. The checkout clerk scans in your food insurance card and helps you fill out your itemized claim. You pay a flat fee of $10 and go home with your groceries. A month later, you get a bill informing you that your food insurance company will pay the supermarket for most of the remaining cost, but you'll have to send in a check for an additional $15. It might sound like a bargain to get a cartload of food for $25, but you're really paying your grocery bill every month when you fork over $2,000 for your food insurance premium. Under such a system, there is little incentive for anyone to find innovative ways to reduce the cost of food or increase its quality. The supermarkets get paid by the insurers, and the insurers get their premiums from you. The cost of food insurance begins to rise as supermarkets stock only the foods that net them the highest insurance payments, not the foods that deliver value to you. As the cost of food insurance rises, many people can no longer afford it. Liberals, motivated by care, push for a new government program to buy food insurance for the poor and the elderly. But once the government becomes the major purchaser of food, then success in the supermarket and food insurance industries depends primarily on maximizing yield from government payouts. Before you know it, that can of peas costs the government $30, and all of us are paying 25% of our paychecks in taxes just to cover the cost of buying groceries for each other at hugely inflated costs. That, says Goldhill, is what we've done to ourselves. As long as consumers are spared from taking price into account, that is, as long as someone else is always paying for your choices, things will get worse. We can't fix the problem by convening panels of experts to set the maximum allowable price for a can of peas. Only a working market can bring supply, demand, and ingenuity together to provide health care at the lowest possible price. For example, there is an open market for LASIK surgery, a kind of laser eye surgery that removes the need to wear contact lenses. Doctors compete with one another to attract customers, and because the procedure is rarely covered by insurance, patients take price into account. Competition and innovation have driven down the price of the surgery by nearly 80% since it was first introduced. Other developed nations have had more success controlling costs, but they too face rapidly rising costs that may become fiscally ruinous. Like Americans, they often lack the political will to raise taxes or cut services. When libertarians talk about the miracle of spontaneous order that emerges when people are allowed to make their own choices and take on the costs and benefits of those choices, the rest of us should listen. Care and compassion sometimes motivate liberals to interfere in the workings of markets, but the result can be extraordinary harm on a vast scale. Of course, as I said above, governments often need to intervene to correct market distortions, thereby making markets work properly. Liberals want to use government for so many purposes, but healthcare expenses are crowding out all other possibilities. If you think your local, state, and federal governments are broke now, just wait until the baby boom generation is fully retired. I find it ironic that liberals generally embrace Darwin and reject intelligent design as the explanation for design and adaptation in the natural world, but they don't embrace Adam Smith as the explanation for design and adaptation in the economic world. They sometimes prefer the intelligent design of socialist economies, which often ends in disaster from a utilitarian point of view. Yang number two, social conservative wisdom. Conservatives are the party of order and stability in Mill's formulation. They generally resist the changes implemented by the party of progress or reform. But to put things in those terms makes conservatives sound like fearful obstructionists trying to hold back the hands of time and the noble human aspirations of the liberal progress narrative. A more positive way to describe conservatives is to say that their broader moral matrix allows them to detect threats to moral capital that liberals cannot perceive. They do not oppose change of all kinds, such as the internet, but they fight back ferociously when they believe that change will damage the institutions and traditions that provide our moral exoskeletons, such as the family. Preserving those institutions and traditions is their most sacred value. For example, the historian Samuel Huntington noted that conservatism can't be defined by the particular institutions it sacralizes, which could be monarchy in 18th century France or the Constitution in 21st century America. Rather, he said, quote, "When the foundations of society are threatened, the conservative ideology reminds men of the necessity of some institutions and the desirability of the existing ones." End quote. At yourmorals.org, we have found that social conservatives have the broadest set of moral concerns, valuing all six foundations relatively equally, as shown in Figure 12.4. The box on top says, "The social conservative moral matrix, most sacred value, preserve the institutions and traditions that sustain a moral community." It is connected by lines of equal width to all six foundations. This breadth, and particularly their relatively high settings on the loyalty, authority, and sanctity foundations, give them insights that I think are valuable from a Durkheimian utilitarian perspective. Counterpoint number two, you can't help the bees by destroying the hive. Liberals hate the idea of exclusion. At a talk I attended a few years ago, a philosophy professor bashed the legitimacy of nation-states. "They're just arbitrary lines on the map," he said. "Some people draw a line and say, everything on this side is ours. The rest of you, keep out." Others in the room laughed along with him. At a talk that I gave recently, I found the same dislike of exclusion applied to religions. A graduate student was surprised by my claim that religions are often good for the rest of society, and she said, "But religions are all exclusive." I asked her what she meant, and she replied, "Well, the Catholic Church won't accept anyone who doesn't believe its teachings." I couldn't believe she was serious. I pointed out that our graduate program at UVA was more exclusive than the church. We rejected almost all applicants. In the course of our discussion, it became clear that her overriding concern was for victims of discrimination, particularly gay people who are told that they don't belong in many religious communities. Comments such as these convince me that John Lennon captured a common liberal dream in his haunting song, Imagine. Imagine if there were no countries and no religion too. If we could just erase the borders and boundaries that divide us, then the world would be as one. It's a vision of heaven for liberals, but conservatives believe it would quickly descend into hell. I think conservatives are onto something. Throughout this book, I've argued that large-scale human societies are nearly miraculous achievements. I've tried to show how our complicated moral psychology co-evolved with our religions and our other cultural inventions, such as tribes and agriculture, to get us where we are today. I have argued that we are products of multi-level selection, including group selection, and that our parochial altruism is part of what makes us such great team players. We need groups, we love groups, and we develop our virtues in groups, even though those groups necessarily exclude non-members. If you destroy all groups and dissolve all internal structure, you destroy your moral capital. Conservatives understand this point. Edmund Burke said it in 1790, quote, "To be attached to the subdivision, to love the little platoon we belong to in society, is the first principle, the germ, as it were, of public affections. It is the first link in the series by which we proceed towards a love to our country and to mankind," end quote. Adam Smith argued similarly that patriotism and parochialism are good things because they lead people to exert themselves to improve the things they can improve. Quote, "That wisdom which contrived the system of human affections seems to have judged that the interest of the great society of mankind would be best promoted by directing the principal attention of each individual to that particular portion of it which was most within the sphere both of his abilities and of his understanding," end quote. Now that's Durkheimian utilitarianism. It's utilitarianism done by somebody who understands human groupishness. Robert Putnam has provided a wealth of evidence that Burke and Smith were right. In the previous chapter, I told you about his finding that religions make Americans into better neighbors and better citizens. I told you his conclusion that the active ingredient that made people more virtuous was enmeshing them into relationships with their co-religionists. Anything that binds people together into dense networks of trust makes people less selfish. In an earlier study, Putnam found that ethnic diversity had the opposite effect. In a paper revealingly titled E Pluribus Unum, Putnam examined the level of social capital in hundreds of American communities and discovered that high levels of immigration and ethnic diversity seemed to cause a reduction in social capital. That may not surprise you. People are racist, you might think, and so they don't trust people who don't look like themselves. But that's not quite right. Putnam's survey was able to distinguish two different kinds of social capital. Bridging capital refers to trust between groups, between people who have different values and identities, while bonding capital refers to trust within groups. Putnam found that diversity reduced both kinds of social capital. Here's his conclusion. Quote, "Diversity seems to trigger not in-group-out-group division, but anomy or social isolation. In colloquial language, people living in ethnically diverse settings appear to hunker down, that is, to pull in like a turtle," end quote. Putnam uses Durkheim's ideas, such as anomy, to explain why diversity makes people turn inward and become more selfish, less interested in contributing to their communities. What Putnam calls turtling is the exact opposite of what I have called hiving. Liberals stand up for victims of oppression and exclusion. They fight to break down arbitrary barriers, such as those based on race and more recently on sexual orientation. But their zeal to help victims, combined with their low scores on the loyalty, authority, and sanctity foundations, often lead them to push for changes that weaken groups, traditions, institutions, and moral capital. For example, the urge to help the inner-city poor led to welfare programs in the 1960s that reduced the value of marriage, increased out-of-wedlock births, and weakened African-American families. The urge to empower students by giving them the right to sue their teachers and schools in the 1970s has eroded authority and moral capital in schools, creating disorderly environments that harm the poor above all. The urge to help Hispanic immigrants in the 1980s led to multicultural education programs that emphasized the differences among Americans rather than their shared values and identities. Emphasizing differences makes many people more racist, not less. On issue after issue, it's as though liberals are trying to help a subset of bees, which really does need help, even if doing so damages the hive. Such reforms may lower the overall welfare of a society, and sometimes they even hurt the very victims liberals were trying to help. Toward more civil politics. The idea of opposites as yin and yang comes from ancient China, a culture that valued group harmony. But in the ancient Middle East, where monotheism first took root, the metaphor of war was more common than the metaphor of balance. The 3rd-century Persian prophet Mani preached that the visible world is the battleground between the forces of light, absolute goodness, and the forces of darkness, absolute evil. Human beings are the front line in the battle. We contain both good and evil, and we must each pick one side and fight for it. Mani's preaching developed into Manichaeism, a religion that spread throughout the Middle East and influenced Western thinking. If you think about politics in a Manichaean way, then compromise is a sin. God and the devil don't issue many bipartisan proclamations, and neither should you. America's political class has become far more Manichaean since the early 1990s, first in Washington and then in many state capitals. The result is an increase in acrimony and gridlock, a decrease in the ability to find bipartisan solutions. What can be done? Many groups and organizations have urged legislators and citizens alike to take civility pledges, promising to be more civil and to view everyone in positive terms. I don't believe such pledges will work. Riders can sign as many of them as they please, but the pledges are not binding for elephants. To escape from this mess, I believe that psychologists must work with political scientists to identify changes that will indirectly undermine Manichaeism. I ran a conference that tried to do this in 2007 at Princeton University. We learned that much of the increase in polarization was unavoidable. It was the natural result of the political realignment that took place after President Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act in 1964. The conservative Southern states, which had been solidly Democratic since the Civil War, because Lincoln was a Republican, then began to leave the Democratic Party, and by the 1990s, the South was solidly Republican. Before this realignment, there had been liberals and conservatives in both parties, which made it easy to form bipartisan teams who could work together on legislative projects. But after the realignment, there was no longer any overlap, either in the Senate or in the House of Representatives. Nowadays, the most liberal Republican is typically more conservative than the most conservative Democrat. And once the two parties became ideologically pure, a liberal party and a conservative party, there was bound to be a rise in Manichaeism. But we also learned about factors that might possibly be reversed. The most poignant moment of the conference came when Jim Leach, a former Republican congressman from Iowa, described the changes that began in 1995. Newt Gingrich, the new Speaker of the House of Representatives, encouraged the large group of incoming Republican congressmen to leave their families in their home districts rather than moving their spouses and children to Washington. Before 1995, congressmen from both parties attended many of the same social events on weekends. Their spouses became friends. Their children played on the same sports teams. But nowadays, most congressmen fly to Washington on Monday night, huddle with their teammates and do battle for 3 days, and then fly home on Thursday night. Cross-party friendships are disappearing. Manichaeism and scorched-earth politics are increasing. I don't know how Americans can convince their legislators to move their families to Washington, and I don't know if even that change would revive cross-party friendships in today's poisoned atmosphere. But this is an example of the kind of indirect change that might change elephants. Intuitions come first, so anything we can do to cultivate more positive social connections will alter intuitions and thus downstream reasoning and behavior. Other structural changes that might reduce Manichaeism include changing the ways that primary elections are run, the ways that electoral districts are drawn, and the ways that candidates raise money for their campaigns. See a full list of potential remedies at www.civilpolitics.org. The problem is not just limited to politicians. Technology and changing residential patterns have allowed each of us to isolate ourselves within cocoons of like-minded individuals. In 1976, only 27% of Americans lived in landslide counties, counties that voted either Democratic or Republican by a margin of 20% or more. But the number has risen steadily. In 2008, 48% of Americans lived in landslide counties. Our counties and towns are becoming increasingly segregated into lifestyle enclaves in which ways of voting, eating, working, and worshiping are increasingly aligned. If you find yourself in a Whole Foods store, there's an 89% chance that the county surrounding you voted for Barack Obama. If you want to find Republicans, go to a county that contains a Cracker Barrel restaurant. 62% of these counties went for McCain. Morality binds and blinds. This is not just something that happens to people on the other side. We all get sucked into tribal moral communities. We circle around sacred values and then share post hoc arguments about why we are so right and they are so wrong. We think the other side is blind to truth, reason, science, and common sense. But in fact, everyone goes blind when talking about their sacred objects. If you want to understand another group, follow the sacredness. As a first step, think about the six moral foundations and try to figure out which one or two are carrying the most weight in a particular controversy. And if you really want to open your mind, open your heart first. If you can have at least one friendly interaction with a member of the other group, you'll find it far easier to listen to what they're saying and maybe even see a controversial issue in a new light. You may not agree, but you'll probably shift from Manichaean disagreement to a more respectful and constructive yin-yang disagreement. In sum, people don't adopt their ideologies at random or by soaking up whatever ideas are around them. People whose genes gave them brains that get a special pleasure from novelty, variety, and diversity, while simultaneously being less sensitive to signs of threat, are predisposed, but not predestined, to become liberals. They tend to develop certain characteristic adaptations and life narratives that make them resonate, unconsciously and intuitively, with the grand narratives told by political movements on the left, such as the liberal progress narrative. People whose genes give them brains with the opposite settings are predisposed, for the same reasons, to resonate with the grand narratives of the right, such as the Reagan narrative. Once people join a political team, they get ensnared in its moral matrix. They see confirmation of their grand narrative everywhere, and it's difficult, perhaps impossible, to convince them that they are wrong if you argue with them from outside of their matrix. I suggested that liberals might have even more difficulty understanding conservatives than the other way around, because liberals often have difficulty understanding how the loyalty, authority, and sanctity foundations have anything to do with morality. In particular, liberals often have difficulty seeing moral capital, which I defined as the resources that sustain a moral community. I suggested that liberals and conservatives are like yin and yang. Both are necessary elements of a healthy state of political life, as John Stuart Mill put it. Liberals are experts in care. They are better able to see the victims of existing social arrangements, and they continually push us to update those arrangements and invent new ones. As Robert F. Kennedy said, quote, "There are those that look at things the way they are and ask, why? I dream of things that never were and ask, why not?" End quote. I showed how this moral matrix leads liberals to make two points that are, in my opinion, profoundly important for the health of a society. One, governments can and should restrain corporate superorganisms. And two, some big problems really can be solved by regulation. I explained how libertarians, who sacralize liberty, and social conservatives, who sacralize certain institutions and traditions, provide a crucial counterweight to the liberal reform movements that have been so influential in America and Europe since the early 20th century. I said that libertarians are right that markets are miraculous, at least when their externalities and other failures can be addressed. And I said that social conservatives are right that you don't usually help the bees by destroying the hive. Finally, I said that the increasing Manichaeism of American political life is not something we can address by signing pledges and resolving to be nicer. Our politics will become more civil when we find ways to change the procedures for electing politicians and the institutions and environments within which they interact. Morality binds and blinds. It binds us into ideological teams that fight each other as though the fate of the world depended on our side winning each battle. It blinds us to the fact that each team is composed of good people who have something important to say. Conclusion. In this book, I took you on a tour of human nature and human history. I tried to show that my beloved topic of inquiry, moral psychology, is the key to understanding politics, religion, and our spectacular rise to planetary dominance. I fear that I crammed too many sites into the tour, so let me close by highlighting the most important ones. In Part 1, I presented the first principle of moral psychology. Intuitions come first, strategic reasoning second. I explained how I came to develop the social intuitionist model, and I used the model to challenge the rationalist delusion. The heroes of this part were David Hume, for helping us escape from rationalism and into intuitionism, and Glaucon, for showing us the overriding importance of reputation and other external constraints for creating moral order. If you bring one thing home from this part of the trip, may I suggest that it be the image of yourself and everyone else around you as being a small rider on a very large elephant. Thinking in this way can make you more patient with other people. When you catch yourself making up ridiculous post hoc arguments, you might be slower to dismiss other people just because you can so easily refute their arguments. The action in moral psychology is not really in the pronouncements of the rider. The second part of our tour explored the second principle of moral psychology. There is more to morality than harm and fairness. I recounted my time in India and how it helped me to step out of my moral matrix and perceive additional moral concerns. I offered the metaphor that the righteous mind is like a tongue with 6 taste receptors. I presented moral foundations theory and the research that my colleagues and I have conducted at yourmorals.org on the psychology of liberals and conservatives. The heroes of this part were Richard Schwader, for broadening our understanding of the moral domain, and Emil Durkheim, for showing us why many people, particularly social conservatives, value the binding foundations of loyalty, authority, and sanctity. If you take home one souvenir from this part of the tour, may I suggest that it be a suspicion of moral monists. Beware of anyone who insists that there is one true morality for all people, times, and places, particularly if that morality is founded upon a single moral foundation. Human societies are complex. Their needs and challenges are variable. Our minds contain a toolbox of psychological systems, including the 6 moral foundations, which can be used to meet those challenges and construct effective moral communities. You don't need to use all 6, and there may be certain organizations or subcultures that can thrive with just one. But anyone who tells you that all societies in all eras should be using one particular moral matrix resting on one particular configuration of moral foundations is a fundamentalist of one sort or another. The philosopher Isaiah Berlin wrestled throughout his career with the problem of the world's moral diversity and what to make of it. He firmly rejected moral relativism. Quote, "I am not a relativist. I do not say, I like my coffee with milk and you like it without. I am in favor of kindness and you prefer concentration camps. Each of us with his own values, which cannot be overcome or integrated. This I believe to be false." End quote. He endorsed pluralism instead and justified it in this way. Quote, "I came to the conclusion that there is a plurality of ideals as there is a plurality of cultures and of temperaments. There is not an infinity of values. The number of human values, of values which I can pursue while maintaining my human semblance, my human character, is finite. Let us say 74, or perhaps 122, or 27, but finite, whatever it may be. And the difference this makes is that if a man pursues one of these values, I, who do not, am able to understand why he pursues it, or what it would be like in his circumstances for me to be induced to pursue it. Hence the possibility of human understanding." End quote. In the third part of our tour, I presented the principle that morality binds and blinds. We are products of multi-level selection, which turned us into homo duplex. We are selfish and we are groupish. We are 90% chimp and 10% bee. I suggested that religion played a crucial role in our evolutionary history. Our religious minds co-evolved with our religious practices to create ever larger moral communities, particularly after the advent of agriculture. I described how political teams form and why some people gravitate to the left, others to the right. The heroes of this part were Charles Darwin, for his theory of evolution, including multi-level selection, and Emil Durkheim, for showing us that we are homo duplex, with part of our nature forged, perhaps, by group-level selection. If you bring one thing home from this last part of the trip, may I suggest that it be the image of a small bump on the back of our heads, the hive switch just under the skin, waiting to be turned on. We've been told for 50 years now that human beings are fundamentally selfish. We're assaulted by reality TV programs showing people at their worst. Some people actually believe that a woman should shout fire if she's being raped on the grounds that everyone is so selfish that they won't even come out to investigate unless they fear for their own lives. It's not true. We may spend most of our waking hours advancing our own interests, but we all have the capacity to transcend self-interest and become simply a part of a whole. It's not just a capacity. It's the portal to many of life's most cherished experiences. This book explained why people are divided by politics and religion. The answer is not, as Manichaeans would have it, because some people are good and others are evil. Instead, the explanation is that our minds were designed for groupish righteousness.